Hey everybody, this week Amanda and I are doing something a little bit different. She is going to cover a historical murder and I'm doing a personal story. So we hope you like it. Thanks.
What do you think you're doing? You're listening to Crime Quest, a podcast covering the cold, the solved, and the theories. Join us.
Hey everyone, it's Amanda. Hope everyone's had a great Thanksgiving if you're in the U.S. If you're listening to us from another country, hope you had a good end of November. I've actually had a really relaxing one with lots of Gilmore Girls and Quiet House as my husband and son are visiting my in-laws. And so it's just me and the cats, and I have been having a lot of fun researching this the historical murder for this week, which actually is going to be about a few murders. So let's talk about this. We're going to look into the asylum poisonings today, and we're going to go back to the Western Lunatic Asylum, which is also called the Western State Asylum, in 1883. And if you remember from the last historical murder, we had Annie Kirby, and she was sent to the asylum after she murdered her husband at the Second Market in Richmond, in the mid-1860s. So, I thought we'd start off with a little bit of information about the asylum so you can learn a little bit more about it, and then we'll get into those murders. So, the Western Asylum is located in Stanton, Virginia. That's in the Shenandoah Valley in the western part of Virginia. In addition to a lunatic asylum, Stanton's also the birthplace of Woodrow Wilson, who was our 28th president, and it's also the home to the Virginia School for the Deaf and Blind. So it's a smaller town. It's about 23,000 people, I think, at the last census. So let's look at the asylum. The asylum, began in 1828. And it actually began as sort of a resort style asylum. One of those things that was very, kind of chic for the time. Patients could go plant flowers in terrace gardens, they could take walks on the grounds, or on these roof paths that they had, the architect had created, so that they could enjoy the mountain views in Stanton. And also the architectural style of the asylum was actually thought to help patients' healing. But in the mid-19th century, probably around the time that Annie was there, the facility had become overcrowded. They started using techniques like ankle and wrist restraints, physical coercion, and they had started using straitjackets as well. And it acted more like a warehouse for patients than a resort. Later on, after the murders that we're going to talk about today, the asylum would actually perform forced sterilizations, lobotomies, and electroshock therapy up until the mid-70s, the 1970s, actually. So, the hospital actually did leave the original location in the mid-70s. After that, it was a medium-security men's penitentiary, and it's now been converted into, apparently, condominiums. So, I don't think the building is still there for people to go out and check out. So, let's talk about these murders. This is going to bring a little bit of history, a little bit of political history, and just some really cool stuff about this time that I didn't even know about until I started looking at this. So let's go back to February 24th, 1883. On the men's ward that morning, all of the patients received their morning medications, but seven of those patients lost consciousness after taking their medication. Out of those seven, four died almost immediately. Two died in the next 3 days, and the last one actually recovered. And there was an eighth patient that vomited and had other symptoms of being ill, but they did recover in a few days. It wasn't as severe as the first seven. All of these victims' cups of medicine had actually been sitting in an unlocked cabinet the evening before, so it was only those patients' cups who had been sitting in that cabinet that had been poisoned. All the other patients were fine. Nothing was found about them. At the asylum, a coroner's inquest was performed. The head pharmacist, who was Dr. W.W.S. Butler, said no medications were missing from the asylum dispensary, and a chemistry professor at the University of Virginia, whose name was John W. Mallett, he used actually latest forensics techniques to analyze the contents of three of the victims' stomachs. So I love that those were starting to become more and more popular for these murder cases. In the victims' stomachs, he found a poison called Echinacea, and that's not to be confused with echinacea that you take to ward off a cold. This is A-C-O-N-I-T-I-A. It is a toxic extract of the aconite plant, which is also known as monk's hood or devil's helmet. So this chemistry professor did the initial autopsies, and then the coroner's jury agreed with those findings. So they were all in agreement that it was from this echinacea plant and a tincture of aconite, which the asylum pharmacy actually did have a bottle of. But Professor Mallett didn't think it was strong enough to cause sudden death. And when they looked around, local drugstores didn't stock any drugs derived from aconite. So the question was, where did this poison come from? So now we're going to get into the superintendent of the asylum. He actually thought that the poisonings were politically motivated in order to discredit him. So he actually was a part of what was called the Readjuster Republican Coalition. It was the administration of Governor William Cameron. So that party was sort of an offshoot of the Republican Party. It was actually formed by a former Confederate general. He was a senator for both the U.S. and Virginia Senates, and a railroad tycoon. His name was William Mahone. So he actually ran for the Conservative Party's gubernatorial nomination in 1877, and he proposed to readjust or repudiate Virginia's post-Civil War debt. And he lost to Frederick W.M. Holliday, who actually went on to win the gubernatorial race in Virginia in 1878. Now, Governor Holliday had actually defended the Conservative Party's plan of funding or completely paying off Virginia's debt, and this was in the Funding Act of 1871. And he was actually against the luxury of free public schools. So, he said they were a luxury. He didn't have them when he was a kid. So, you know, it was one of those things that's it's a privilege, not a requirement. So, sounds kind of familiar with the political atmosphere right now with a few things. So, public sentiment didn't actually agree with Holliday. So they actually, those who didn't agree, came out and formed what was called the Readjuster Party. And it was kind of a miscellaneous alliance of conservatives and Republicans, both white and black citizens, who wanted to reduce state debt and restore social services, like schools, that sort of thing. So Mahone was actually the voice of the Readjusters from 1879 to 1883, and he helped get William Cameron elected to the governor's position in 1882, and he was a former mayor of Petersburg, which is a town just south of Richmond. So Cameron, once he was elected, he didn't hesitate to use his patronage power, and that included appointing a new board of directors to the Western Lunatic Asylum, who then appointed Hamilton as superintendent and replaced most of the staff. So Hamilton was thinking that somebody was trying to discredit him because he was the superintendent and because of the party that he belonged to. So he wanted to kind of go in and prove that that was the case. So he actually hired Pinkerton's National Detective Agency. And you may have heard of them before. They're actually a huge security agency now, I believe. I think if you're Canadian, there was a Canadian TV show about them a couple of years ago called The Pinkertons. It was they were actually founded in 1850 by Alan Pinkerton, and he actually gained fame because he claimed to stop a plot to assassinate President-elect Lincoln, and then Lincoln actually hired his agents later for his personal security during the Civil War. So they had a really good reputation, and I guess Hamilton really just wanted the best on this so he could clear his name and clear his asylum's name. And Clara's party's name, actually, as we're talking about this. So there were two Pinkerton agents that traveled to Richmond, Alexandria, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and Philadelphia, and they went to search for druggists who sold Echinacea, but they didn't find really anybody who sold it. So that kind of, that was really a dead end for them. So at this point, we get into a little bit of espionage. A Pinkerton agent, F.M. Smiley, who was 27 years old with two medical degrees, which he must have gone to school forever. Maybe not back then, but he actually posed as a patient who was suffering from melancholia, what they called depression, for 2 months. So he got in there. He was able to talk to the other inmates at the asylum. He was able to kind of overhear conversations, talk to the staff. He apparently was... He played the part of suffering from melancholia, but when he got in there, he had very lucid periods, or pretended to have very lucid periods, and I think it sounded like the lucid periods kind of outweighed the parts where he was pretending to be suffering from that intense depression. So he actually produced a number of suspects, and we're going to go through those. The first two we're going to kind of group together here. Charles J. Armistead, he was also a melancholia patient who was a former theology student, and he had attempted suicide by drug overdose. The Superintendent Hamilton called him a thorough chemist who was familiar with drugs. Bolivar Christian is our next suspect. He was a lawyer and former Confederate officer, and he had accused Dr. Butler, the head pharmacist, of tampering with his medicine. So why were they suspected? Hamilton said that they were, quote, sharp, shrewd, highly educated, unquote, as well as being strong Democrats and in opposition to the current management of the asylum. Both had access to the hall when the medicine was poisoned. So again, we're getting back into that political side of things and thinking that everything goes back to that readjuster party and someone being upset that Hamilton's in power at the asylum. So the next suspect was someone named Hull, last name of Hull. He was an asylum supervisor. He did not like Hamilton and, according to Smiley, quote, would stoop to any low cussedness, unquote. So I don't think that was a good thing back in 1883. So Smiley spent a lot of time with Armistead, Christian, and Hull in order to gain information, anything that they knew about the poisonings. And he didn't, he spent some time with them, but there was nothing concrete that came out of it. The next suspect that he had was Dr. H.S. Crockett. He was actually Hamilton's second in command, and there were also rumors that he really disliked Dr. Hamilton and really didn't want him to be, his, superior. So his connection there, his uncle, William B. Byers, had been a patient at the asylum for 3.5 years. He was being treated for melancholia, and he also had unusual access to the pharmacy due to his connection to Dr. Crockett. 3 weeks after the poisonings, Byers was discharged and quickly moved to Texas. In Smiley's report, he stated that, quote, the general opinion is that Dr. Crockett furnished the Echinacea and that his uncle used it, unquote, meaning his uncle had surreptitiously dispensed it to those victims. So, I mean, that seems like a really interesting piece of timing there. There's no really further information on him being a suspect, but, I mean, that timing strikes me as a little crazy. The next suspect is a man named Duett Andrews. He was actually an asylum attendant, and he was also one of the few remaining Democrats on the staff. And he told Smiley that he thought the poisoning was done to, quote, beat the damned readjusters, and I wouldn't squeal if I knew, unquote. So apparently he didn't really care that someone had done this, as long as it came out looking bad on this party. So Smiley, the agent, theorized that Andrews was working with another attendant and also a former attendant who had been fired, but that attendant was back in Stanton the day before the poisonings. So then we come to the conclusions of Smiley's investigation, as well as the public's conclusion. The editor of the Stanton Telegram was actually a Democrat, and he attributed the poisonings to accidents at Dr. Butler's hand, but not as murder. So Dr. Butler was responsible, but it was all an accident. He didn't mean to. R.J. Linden, who was the Pinkerton superintendent, he actually produced a final report from Smiley's investigation undercover. In this report, he didn't entertain the possibility that the deaths were caused by a patient or staff member, and he concluded that the poisonings were not the result of carelessness or lack of precaution on the part of the facility. He also concluded that the poisonings were committed by parties outside of the institution and claimed it would be, quote, injudicious to name at this time, unquote. So he was trying to basically stay on Hamilton's good side with this. They didn't think it was a, or he didn't know, think it was a patient or staff member, and it had to be done from somebody outside of the asylum. And then Hamilton also said that Smiley gave him reason to believe that he had additional information that he hadn't, that hadn't been reported, and because of this information, Smiley suspected a certain individual, but whoever that individual was, they never brought that to the forefront. And at this point, no charges were filed against anyone in the case, and the Asylum Board of Directors considered themselves and Hamilton vindicated due to the Pinkerton report by Linden. So you'd think that would be the end of it. No, and actually because of the political climate going on, their adversaries felt differently about the results. And John N. Opie, who was a Democratic member of the House of Delegates for Augusta County in the city of Stanton, called for an investigation of the asylum's gross mismanagement. They formed a special committee of House and Senate members chaired by Opie, and it was comprised of a majority of the Assembly's Democratic members. So there was also a minority group as well, and both of them issued separate reports on this. The majority group concluded that Mallett's conclusions, the UVA professor, were faulty, and the tincture in the hospital pharmacy did actually contain enough aconite to cause death, and that 5 drops of the medication would result in death. But then the minority report sided with Mallett and stated that even a full cup of the tincture wasn't enough to contain the amount found in the analysis. So the next one was that Smiley, the majority, said that he was a cheat and fraud, the agent was trying to extort money from Hamilton. The minority report said they found no evidence of fraud. So again, completely at odds right there. The majority report also said that there was no evidence whatsoever to show that the poisonings had been done by anyone outside of the asylum. And then regardless of whether or not they were killed by someone in the asylum or an outside party, the majority report placed the responsibility for the deaths squarely on the shoulders of the asylum administration. The minority report disputed this, though. They said that they were not negligent and, in fact, had taken more precautions than previous administrations. So a lot of back and forth. And then the majority report lastly stated that the former staff and officers were removed by Hamilton and the board of directors simply for their Democratic political leanings. And I don't find that too hard to believe with the negativity between the two parties. It does not sound like that would have been outside the realm of belief right there. So, because of this committee report, plus other complaints, acts were passed by the General Assembly in 1883 to 1884, and they removed the boards of all state hospitals in Virginia on April 15th, 1884, and they took that authority to choose the new boards from the governor, and they placed it back in the hands of the Board of Public Works. So after that change, Hamilton and his management team were gone from the asylum, and the former administration that had been in place before the 1881 elections were restored to their positions. So basically everybody just returned. There was only one change with these staff changes. The asylum brought on a new staff member, and his name, he was a clerk, his name was C.J. Armistead. And if you remember that name from a few minutes ago, he was one of the former inmates and suspects. So, make of that what you will, because the murders have never been solved, and more than 130 years later, the guilty party still remains a mystery. So, yeah, that's our historical murder for this week. I don't know what you guys think about that. If you, I'd love to hear who you think might have done it, because I'm a little bit torn between the uncle and Armistead. I think that's a pretty good, there's a pretty good indication that it was done by somebody inside the asylum. And it, I mean, you're gonna leave a cabinet unlocked with medications in it. You're pretty much just begging for somebody to get poisoned. So anyway, thanks for joining. I'll be back next week with some more. We'll both be back with some more murders, another historical murder, and we'll talk to you then. Bye.
That was Amanda's historical murder, and here's my personal story. So keep in mind that this was recorded about 2 years ago and has more of a creative sound to it. So I hope you like it. I've noticed when I take naps in the middle of the day, I experience sleep paralysis. I'll wake up but can't move or speak, and I struggle to try to call for help. All the while, I think I can hear Jamie in the other room watching TV or talking on the phone. I've heard that some people see horrible things during this paralysis and think they are being visited by demons or ghosts. I'm lying in bed with one eye open and screaming inside to move. I try to jostle my body, but nothing happens. I can't speak or even move a finger. My only hope is that the episode will end soon or that someone will nudge me. The last time this happened, my cat Mal jumped on me and I was able to wake up. Usually I have to wake up on my own. When this happens, it's a huge relief, but I often cry because I'm so terrified. I sit up and take in what it's like to live and have the freedom to move my body, to seize every moment and not take a single thing for granted. Time seems to slow down when you are in this state. Time doesn't exist. Back to demons. When I was in my first year of college, I came home for the obligatory Christmas visit. My mom's house is in the country and sits on 52 acres of land. The land has been in my family for generations, and you can feel the unbridled energy of the past pulsing around you when you stand in the front field. We moved to this house when I was 9 from an upper middle class suburb. The move was exciting and ultimately character building, and to this day I love to come back and visit the old home place. Anyway, it was Christmas Eve, and the usual song and dance of going to bed early because Santa was coming happened despite the fact that we all know this is not real. What's ironic about that thought is that I experienced something that night that one could argue also wasn't real. But I feel it was real. Something woke me up. It wasn't a sound, but a silence and a very strong feeling. It was similar to when your bladder wakes you up to alert you that it needs emptying. It was an urgent feeling. It wasn't a scary feeling, but a gentle sense of need. Like I really needed to wake up. It happened so fast, and to this day, I can't be completely sure if it even happened. All I have is the memory and the feeling left to carry me through to right now. The bed my mother used to replace mine in my old bedroom was very hard, and the sheets and covers were new, so not as soft as you might think. The room was so clean now that no longer carried the faint smell of cigarettes and perfume from my teenage years. Also, my old room is a room of extremes, being either really cold or really warm, depending on the season. In this case, I was cold, so naturally I was bundled up in those new covers, to the point where I was almost sweating. As this feeling took over, I slowly opened my eyes to what I thought would be an empty room. Nothing prepared me for what I saw. I was paralyzed. I closed my eyes quickly, and what I saw was a man. Actually, more like a guy close to my age. He had on a blue and white flannel shirt. He was dark-haired, but couldn't make out his face because I closed my eyes so fast. He just stood there, and he said nothing. When I awoke the next morning, which was Christmas Day, I told my mom and stepfather what happened. They shrugged it off and said it was probably a dream. You would think I would be terrified, but I just wasn't. I was curious. I wanted to know who this was. Christmas came and went, but the memory was so fresh in my mind. According to some online lore, several people have accounts of this someone known as the Lumberjack Man visiting them in the night during their episodes of sleep paralysis. The accounts vary from people seeing his face to having him come towards them. I can't say for sure if this person is who I saw, but I do know that he showed himself again in my room when I came back to college a few months later. The story is the same, and I just couldn't make out his face and went right back to sleep. Is he a demon coming to visit me in the night? If so, why only twice? And why the flannel? Thank you for listening to Crime Quest. It is our goal to make this as informative as possible. If you heard something amazing and want to give us a review, please do so on iTunes along with a rating. If you have suggestions for show topics, please send them to crimequestpod@gmail.com. Also, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Crime Quest Pod. Thanks. Crime Quest would like to give special thanks to Hemi Haynes for putting together our music for this episode. Thanks, Hemi.